When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to a slightly delayed episode of How to Be Sound, your one-stop guide to being, well, that little bit better at being human. I should add a nod to Sophie Hagen. Her excellent podcast, Made of Human, is definitely one of the inspirations for How to Be Sound, even though I think if you listen to the two, you'll find that Sophie interrupts her guests a lot less than I do. This episode of How to Be Sound is brought to you by my innate inability to stick to a schedule. I had another guest lined up last week, but due to a series of unfortunate and boring events, we had to postpone. So despite my previous promises to release an episode every 2 weeks, here we are. A massive thank you so much to everyone who's taken the time to rate and review How to Be Sound. The massive majority of my reviews are overwhelmingly positive, which is frankly overwhelming. I do have one star review that was left in the very early days of the podcast and just says, poor. So I'm hoping that's just somebody who really hates me and not someone who listens to a lot of podcasts and has a discerning ear for radio. I have a lot of updates on my Patreon page as well, though I've been a little bit quiet on the actual podcast. I've been writing a lot more lately and updating my Patreon pretty regularly. So it's basically now like a mix between my podcast and my blog. I'm uploading some minisodes and also some writing that I'm kind of trialing out on a small audience. And I've also updated the rewards. So if you don't know, Patreon is basically a way you can tell me, hey, I like what you're doing, please keep doing it, by pledging a small amount of money each month. So my $1 patrons get access to the super secret, not that secret, How to Be Sound book club and access to a lot of Patreon-only content. For $3.33 or more per month, you'll get that. Plus, I'll read out your name at the end of every episode, coming later. For $6.66 a month, you'll get a mini-sode to boot. And for $9.99, you'll get all of that plus two mini-sodes per month. So it's a bargain. You can check that out on patreon.com/howtobesound. Now, I am joined today by someone I think will probably be familiar to you all, although not as familiar as I am with her, having been on, I think, maybe two podcasts with her by now. Not my own. They were her.ie's Girls with Goals, which is also recommended. And I've also shared a stage with her, kind of. It's comedian Joanne McNally. Joanne, welcome to How to Be Sound.
Thank you, Rachel.
I can tell already that you're blown away by our high-tech studio.
I love it.
Before we get started, right, I would like to do a bit of an icebreaker. I'm sure as a comedian, you get very nervous doing these kinds of things. So just to get you used to like recording and stuff.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time we met? What do you remember about the first time you met me, Rosemary McCabe?
The first time we met, I think, was that Caniston gig, wasn't it?
I think it was. Yeah.
And in the Liffey Trust.
Yes.
You came in. Yeah, I think that was it. In the Liffey Trust. We were doing a rehearsal there. And it was you and Pamela Joyce.
Did you immediately know that we were just going to get on really, really well?
I didn't know what you were going to be like, to be honest.
Oh,
I was
really?
Like, yeah, I didn't know what you were going to be like because you're kind of like a bit controversial online.
I'm not anymore.
No, you're not really anymore.
No, I probably am a bit sometimes.
But at the time,
I'm better now.
You were. And there was something, you'd just written an article that was everywhere. I'm trying to remember what it was now.
Was it about the Gossies?
It was about the, no, although you had written that thing about the Gossies, yes. But it was something after that as well. And I didn't know what you were going to be like, but I was pleasantly surprised.
No, people always say I'm nicer in real life.
Yeah.
They think I'm going to be. But actually the first time, I mean, that's the first time that we met.
We got
the
on.
First time.
We actually got on, yeah.
Yeah. We did. The first time though that I was aware of your existence was in Singlehood.
Yeah,
which I saw in wasn't Smock Alley. It was The Project.
The Project. That was the first, my first kind of stage gig. And was that? Yeah,
was that the first, like the first thing you ever did? Like, like were you trying to do stuff before that, or was that just,
that was it?
How did that come about?
I did. The last thing I'd done before that was my nativity play in Loretta Dawkey, which wasn't a standard nativity play. We did.
Of course it wasn't. Loretto Dawkey.
Of course it wasn't. Do you know what it was? It was called Papa Panov, and it was a play about the French or the Russian Revolution. And I was the Tsar.
Was this in primary school?
Yeah. We were like eight. And we were all dressed up as like Russian peasants and like Russian
aristocracy. Well, you weren't, because you were the Tsar.
No, I was the Tsar. So I was the villain. And we were just saying, like, bread, give us bread. If you don't, we'll soon be dead. Yeah. I know, it's so weird. So weird. And I started talking to someone about it through the day, and they were like, you did it. Your Christmas play was about the Russian Revolution. I was like, yeah, it was, yeah. Papa Panov. And Papa Panov was the main role.
And, like,
which went to Jill Farrelly.
Oh. And what's she doing now?
I don't know. She's like an accountant.
Is she
now
killing
or something.
It in, like, the Edinburgh
Fringe?
She's in
Broadway.
Oh, no, she's an accountant.
She's an accountant.
Okay. She probably has more money than all three of us put together.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
You know what's interesting? I was thinking about this today about how much I liked you in Singlehood. Because I remember at the time really liking you, but also now, so this isn't a huge compliment, I was kind of surprised by the fact that I liked you. Because I think we all have perceptions or kind of subconscious biases about our comedy and what we like in our comedy, right?
Of course.
And a part of me was like, I'm never going to like a straight white girl with a posh voice.
Yeah.
Being a comedian. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
And then I was like, oh, you're really funny. And
I get that a lot.
Yeah, but I'd say actually in Ireland, and maybe it's kind of now, like maybe in 5 years' time it'll be different, but I'd say it's easier in Ireland, weirdly, to be a female comedian if you have a working class accent.
Oh yeah.
Than it is if you have a posh voice.
100%. Sorry, I just spent a lot of time at the weekend with someone who says 100% a lot, so now I say 100%. But completely. My accent, which I really, really, I know this sounds mad, but I really was not aware of it before I started doing stage stuff. Certainly, I suppose, because I wasn't, no one was judging me, or I wasn't being
but I mean, like,
inspected.
You're also hanging out with your mates.
Who all
You're not on a stage getting, like,
same.
Reading reviews and going, what are people saying about
me? Yeah, and I think, like what you said, but with the way I sound, and it's a Southside accent, but it's something more than a Southside accent. It's like a Southside accent on acid. It's like there's an actual dart in my mouth, and I don't know where it came from. I don't know why it's like that. I think Dawkey Kalini has a particular accent. I think it's the real Ross O'Carroll Kelly. It's that totally, but which, like, when I parody, people say, but you're not even doing a parody because that's
you're just doing your own accent, but
more
accent.
People don't like it. I remember Ciara King, who I work with a lot in 2FM, said to me, you know, you have the most hated accent in Ireland. And I was like, do I? She's like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And I was like, grant. So to get up on stage then and be doing jokes, people automatically, either they actually don't want to like you or they assume they're not going to like you. And I copped that very fast. So I started, I remember one woman saying to me once, I like you because you sound posh, but you talk like a knacker. And I was like, I'm putting that on all my posters. Because I think that is, like, I know I have a posh Southside accent, and I know it makes people want to, like, throw bottles of urine at me, but I don't have airs and graces, if you know that kind of way.
But I mean, you're basically engaging in cultural appropriation then. Because you have this posh accent, you're from this privileged place, but you get to act like a knacker on stage and make money from it. Whereas,
cultural appropriation.
Yeah, whereas people who are actually from working class areas are really struggling. Joanne, how do you feel about that?
Oh, come on. That's like with that time I wore hoop earrings and someone was like, you're culturally appropriating the Mexicans. And I was like, fuck off.
The Mexicans?
Something like that. The Cholos. I was like, give me a break.
I'm sure everyone likes a hoop earring.
I know, but this was the thing. Lena Dunham was saying to eat sushi, your culture is wrong because you're culturally appropriating Asian culture.
No, I mean, I think to put a photograph of yourself eating sushi on your Instagram in full on like Japanese geisha garb is a bit dodge.
But
eating sushi on a Thursday, grand.
Even so, and this is why I really liked you when I first met you, because I think we've very different opinions on things, but we debate them well, if you know that kind of way. Like, there's no, like, animosity between us in any way. But why is that wrong to wear Asian gear?
So,
like, I wouldn't, if okay, say, I'm trying to think of someone who dresses nothing like I do. Like, as in culturally.
Okay, so,
when would I ever be offended if someone appropriated my culture?
But you wouldn't, because you're from a position of privilege and a position of superiority, economically speaking.
But
so, like, no, but, like, so you are a white, straight woman, whereas geishas, historically in Japan, were often kind of indentured, or they were sold into it, and they didn't have so much of a choice. So for us to go over and dress up in their outfits for fun without recognising any of it behind it, and, like, the thing is as well, some people go to these tea rooms, and they go and they do a whole ceremony, and they dress up in the garb, and they pay, like, you know, pretty decent money for it. And I'm going, well, those people need to make a living, and I'm sure you're doing that with the utmost of respect that you can muster from what you understand of this culture. And I don't think that's so bad as, like, if I'm dressing up as a geisha for a Halloween party without any reference or any thought behind where does this come from and what does this mean to the people who are actually from this culture. Do you know what I mean? So it's not so much like, I don't have a problem with somebody dressing up like a Japanese person, but if it's somebody dressing up in an outfit from a culture that has historically been put upon for how they look or for how they dress, then it becomes problematic. So, like, the Indian headdresses and stuff.
Yeah.
Native American.
Yeah.
Oh my God, shoot me now.
Yeah, and they have a real problem with that. And I remember reading at the time that they had a problem with people. There was a trend of young girls going in and getting tattoos of dream catchers. And Native Americans were like, this is not cool. We're not into this. And that I can understand.
Yeah.
But there has to be... It's not black and white.
Like, no,
it's
not, but nothing is.
No, nothing is. And I think there's so much nuance. And I think with the cultural appropriation thing, sometimes when things kind of... When I feel like they, in my mind, that it's being pushed too far, then I just go, right, well, like, fuck it. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah.
You become unsympathetic then.
Yeah.
Because you think you're being made out to be this racist cultural appropriator that you're not. A friend of mine called me a fascist last year. I know.
What were you doing? Were you dressing up in, like, SS gear at a Halloween party?
We still argue about it. But do you know my brother, when we were kids, he dressed up as a Nazi for Halloween.
But we also didn't know back then.
Yeah, we didn't know.
Do you know what
but
I mean?
My, like, parents,
we all
dressed him. My parents did it.
But you're...
My mum drew the swastika onto a suit. It was adorable. I was dressed as a princess with my sparkler, and he was a full on Nazi dude with the little moustache.
Why did he want to be a Nazi?
Who knows?
Is he really blonde? Feel like he really belonged
No.
there? Oh.
And you know what's so funny? The next year, and this is the God's honest truth, Mum was like, I think we'll dress you as something a little, you know, less controversial. Do you know who we went as? Jimmy Savile. Jimmy Savile.
She couldn't have known.
She really couldn't have known. How could you have known? Imagine. Now if you opened the door and there was a little kid there dressed as a Nazi, you'd have his parents in prison for hate crimes, wouldn't you? You would, like. And that was only in the 90s or something. Like, he was only about 21 or 22. No, I'm asking, he was like 9 or something.
Your poor brother. He's doing, like, totally doing a Harry Windsor on it. You know what the thing is, though? Like, I saw, was it Daniela Moyles, right, went to one of these Japanese geisha things and dressed up as a Japanese geisha and put a picture on Instagram, and a load of people were going absolutely apeshit. Mm. And my main question is, well, what do the Japanese people and what do the people of Asian heritage think? Because it's not like I'm often the person who's like, I think this is a disgrace on Twitter. But then I'm like, who am I? I'm like fucking posh white girl sitting in her gaff in Dublin One. Like,
yeah.
I should defer to the people of colour and to the people whose heritage might be feeling taken advantage by that. You know what I mean?
I don't agree with people, because it's happened to me a couple of times where men have basically told me that I should be offended about something that's been said on stage. Okay, so say at a comedy, in a comedy club or whatever. And that just blows my mind, because I'm like, well, firstly, why? This is a man telling me as a woman that I should be offended by what a man said. Like, I'm like, no, I will decide what I'm offended by or not offended by.
Yeah.
And no more than that, that geisha thing. What would be interesting is, I don't know, you know, I know you don't have access to geishas, but to be offended on behalf of someone else, it just makes me want to take a massive nap.
You have
to talk to the people that you think you're.
Take a massive
it does.
Nap.
You want to talk to the people who you think are offending. I saw, I don't know, I think it was Una Mullally did a tweet recently where she used the word queer, talking about herself or her friends or whatever.
Yeah.
And of course, people were like, you can't use that word. Why? How come we can't use that word and you can use that word? And she was like, well, I'm owning my queerness. And I was like, oh my God, like, so straight people are getting offended on behalf of other gay people because a gay person's using the word queer. Like, it would make you just want to lie down, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Now, the thing for me is, I think there's a big difference between being offended and recognizing that something is potentially offensive. So do you know what I mean? Like,
online there's no difference, because you're still sending out the tweet saying what you've just said is wrong, I don't
agree. No, but say in the case of a man saying to you, you should be offended, right? If you all step back, right, you strip away all of your gender and you try to think about it really,
which is impossible
really,
to do.
No, I know, of course. But like, you try to think about it really, really objectively and go, well, look, is what that person said offensive? Not necessarily to you personally, but is it offensive on some level where you're like, you know, he could have come up with, I'm presuming it's a man, it's always a man, like saying offensive shit.
Yeah.
But, you know, could he have been funny about that topic in a way that wasn't potentially offensive? I think that's an interesting question to ask, rather than going, are you not offended as a woman?
Yeah.
It's like, well, maybe you don't get offended, but that doesn't mean something's not offensive.
Yeah, but then there's always going to be someone who's everything's offensive to someone. Do you know that way? And
yeah.
I think, I suppose, because I'm a stand-up and I'm in comedy clubs, and this kind of conversation comes up a lot. Like,
yeah,
what's too much? Where's the line? Like, what can you make jokes about? What can't you make jokes about? And I think it's harder. I mean, look, it affects everyone. It's everyone's kind of having chats with themselves and their friends at the moment. But I do think if you put comedy and stand-up in a place where, you know, you have to have your script proofread by an activist and a feminist and all these other types and groups of people to make sure it's appropriate. Where does that, what am I, I'm going to go out on stage and read a lullaby? Like, what am I going to do? And I think you have to be able to push boundaries, especially in stand-up. I think that's like the last place you're able to do it. And sometimes, yeah, people do go too far. But if you go too far, the audience will tell you. The audience will tell you if you go too far. I've seen it happen in clubs. I saw one stand-up one night try and make a joke about something that had just happened, something very sensitive. It was about the child who washed up on the shore in Syria, right? The Syrian child, sorry, who washed up on the shore. And he tried to do a joke about it and literally...
How?
Listen, I don't know. It was a couple of years ago now. But I remember the whole audience just went, no! Literally just no. And he went, no, wait, no. They went, no. And that was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And it was inappropriate. It was wrong. It wasn't going to work. And they put him back in his box. And I think there's other situations where sometimes I think, what's wrong with being offended? It's not going to kill you. There are bigger issues at play in the world. And I also think I've been introduced on stage sometimes as... one time I did a feminist event and I was going down to try material on abortion and stuff that had worked in clubs about feminism. And it was a different room and they were saying, before I came on, they were introducing the night, saying it was a safe space. And I'm like, oh God, what am I going to do here? Because comedy clubs aren't, like, I don't want to work in a comedy club that's a safe space. I don't know what that comedy world is. It's not for me.
No,
I want to be able to take the piss out of things. I want to be able to push boundaries. I'm not offensive. I'm not an offensive comic. I don't want to hear rape jokes. If a man makes a rape joke, I will leave and I will never watch that comic again. But I'm not going to try and destroy his
career over it.
Do you know what I mean?
You know what the thing for me is, that I think, yes, there is space to offend people, and I don't think comedy should be quote unquote safe. But I do think that the people who should be offended, like, in an ideal comedy world, we'd be offending the people who are, say, like, the people who are fully able-bodied, who are really privileged, who are, you know, in a position of economic superiority, who are maybe, like, the assholes, or, like, the people who are idiots.
Who decides
making the
that?
I know, but, like, so I'm in this group on Facebook, and they're mostly based in Australia. It's, like, women. It's very woke. Well, like, you have to answer a quiz to get in, and one of them... Yeah, and one of the quiz questions is, do you think white racism is a thing, like racism against white people? And another one of the quiz questions is, do you think sex work is real work? So you have to be, like, super feminist to be in this group.
Okay,
right?
And do you think white racism is a thing?
No.
Okay, and what was the other question?
Do you think sex work is real work?
I would say it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, it's fucking hard as well.
Yeah,
yeah. It is.
Yeah. Okay. I'm such a lazy bitch.
I know.
If I could get my boyfriend to pay for my sex, I would... 100% take that cash. Sometimes I offer blowjobs for lifts. Anyway, sorry.
Oh.
Go back to.
Well, listen. That's just. I'm like, yeah, totally. That's just a barter system. Sometimes I'd be like,
yeah.
You know what you love now. You know what I love when you go to the shop for me. You know what you love.
Yeah, a bit.
Yeah.
For my boyfriend's last birthday, I didn't have any real money to speak of because I'm doing a lot of travel to the UK at the moment and everything goes into that and Zara. So basically, I got him sex vouchers. So I thought this would be a great idea. So, like, you know.
Oh no. Did he try and cash them all in on a day when you're like roasting and wrecked?
So the point is, he was like, what? So he keeps trying to whip them out and I'm like, no, I'm not in the mood. And he's like, Joanne, what is the point of using them if you're in the mood? If you're in the mood, I don't need to use them. And I'm like, oh my God. So I'm running out the door to work and he's like waving a blowjob voucher. And I'm like, no, it's not the time. So I'm going to, if I ever do the voucher system again, I'm going to have to put in some heavy T's and C's at the back.
But also like, I don't know if this is me being really emotional, but like, why do men want to do it when you're not in the mood?
He's totally joking. He is. One time I tried to watch a documentary.
Historically, like... Oh.
Yeah.
Well,
Yeah, go on.
I have a friend who conceived while watching The Handmaid's Tale.
What?
That's fucked up. But sorry, can I get back to my feminist group, right?
Yes.
They were talking about one of the girls had been to, one of the women had been to a comedy show in Australia somewhere, let's say Brisbane. It's the only town I can think of. City. And the comic had made a joke about autism and he had, basically somebody had handed him a note from the audience and when he went to read it, he went, oh, I can't, I'm going to do, sorry, that can never read really bad. Fair income, I can't read this. And he went, are you autistic or something, mate? But he said it several times.
Yeah.
And she said that she and her friend were so offended. And there was something else he said, they were so offended that they got up and they left. And then she left a review on the club's Facebook page and just said, I felt really unsafe. And which I think is slightly dramatic.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said that.
I can understand.
She felt unsafe by a word on the stage.
Yeah, now... I think, like, maybe she has a sibling with very extreme autism. You know what I mean? That there are levels where people are totally functioning and then other people can't speak. So I think he has very debilitating autism. And she said that she just felt really upset that she'd come in to, like, get away from her life and just have, like, fun for 2 hours. And she suddenly was like, oh my God, you're attacking my brother. And she, you know, she was really upset. But she left this review on the club's page basically saying I didn't feel safe and I've come here a lot of times and I thought this was really out of line, blah blah blah, and the comedian himself wrote back and got so aggro and like literally went into every single cliche of like you snowflake, you're so weak, you need to grow a pair, like literally just went off on one.
Yeah.
And it turned into such an amazing shit show of just like back and forth. And also she posted in this like really active feminist group. Yeah, I'll send it to you. And she posted in this super active group and then everybody was like back and forth. It was amazing.
Yeah, I'd love to read that.
It was feverish.
Because I think I'm somewhere in the middle of that. I'm not him and I'm not her.
Yeah.
I'm somewhere in the middle. And I think most people are in the middle. I think most people are somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You know? Like I'd be a very, politically I'm a very left person. Like I'm a left person. But I do feel, sometimes I feel like I'm terrified to tweet. I'm terrified to, will this joke work? Will that joke work? And you get frustrated with it.
I can give you like a workshop for the tweeting.
Oh God.
Sometimes I tweet and then like 2 hours later I'm like, what the fuck did I do that for?
You see, you're in a different position because I suppose, we're all just trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
But I don't, that whole thing, like I feel unsafe, unless like someone's coming at you with a Stanley knife. Like I don't think words can make you feel unsafe. Unless someone's threatening you physically.
I mean.
I think that is a bit.
Like.
I think she does need to grow a pair.
Yeah.
I said it. Well, sorry. I think she does.
Well, like grow a pair just annoys me because balls are so delicate. Like grow a pair and do what with them.
She needs to grow a set of tits.
Just like.
She needs to
grow some armor,
psychological
armor. Yeah. But I mean, I do think words could make you feel unsafe. Say if we're going right, totally like hypothetical. Say if you're in a comedy venue and you look around, you're like, oh, there's like nearly, you know, well, we're pretty much the only women here, and there's like nearly all men, and then they start making jokes about sexual assault or about rape or something. Then I guess like I understand how you could feel unsafe in that environment.
Same, yeah.
But for her, when I'm a bit like, well. It wasn't a funny joke.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a funny joke.
That he made. And like, you could totally then take that up with him and be like, that wasn't actually funny. It was just stupid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
But I do think the reaction was a bit extreme. Let's get back to you for a second, right?
Yeah.
So on a scale of, right, like, Billy Murphy, who's like playing an open mic night in Boris.
Mm-hmm.
Boris Sinatra.
I'm a huge fan of Billy, actually.
Right. On a scale of him to Amy Schumer, where are you now?
Oh, God. Well, I'd definitely be closer to Billy.
But how do you know, like, as a comedian, what are your benchmarks? So, you know, when you're like, say, if you're trying to be a singer and you're like, my dream is always to do X. So what are the benchmarks in comedy?
So, yeah. So you have to kind of learn the ropes, basically. That's why me and Alison Spittler were talking about this the other day. We were doing an interview, actually, for this Vodafone Festival is coming up soon, and they were talking about the excitement about the amount of women on the lineup. I'm kind of digressing, maybe we'll get there. And I was saying, it's so cool. I said, it's so deadly. I said, but you have to give those women a chance to get good. Like, you know, there's this thing that's like, oh, there's a female comic, and it's so exciting because we were starved of them for so long that there's a lot of pressure put on them then. And what people forget is you have to learn how to do stand up. And the only way of learning that is to do loads of shit gigs and good gigs and all that jazz.
So you think that like a woman who comes forward and goes, I'm trying to be a comedian, is suddenly put on a big stage and
I
you're
think
like, fuck,
I
she's not ready for this.
I don't think it's definitely going to happen, but there's a very strong chance it can happen. Yeah. And I think whereas men are left in the clubs for maybe longer because there isn't...
There's so fucking many of them.
There's so many of them. Yeah. Exactly. There's so many of them. So they have a chance to kind of learn their craft more.
This is so funny because did you read the article the Mirror wrote about this quote?
No.
And
what quote?
So the quote from you about saying that you think that women are sometimes pushed.
No, I didn't know that they'd used it.
I'm pretty sure it was the Mirror. And they basically, I think the headline was like, Joanne McNally says, is basically against gender quotas.
Oh, for fuck's
sake. So it was kind of saying that like Joanne McNally's worried that women are being used to fill quotas. And then when I read it, I was like, oh, I kind of get the point you're making.
Yeah, no, I don't think that.
But like the initial
all.
Thing, I was like, oh, we're going to have to talk about this. And then I read it and I was like, oh, no, I get it.
No, it's that I worry that... It's too much pressure on them, do you know, that kind of way that it's like, brilliant, yes, another female comic is coming through. Here's this festival gig in front of 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And potentially they're not ready for it, whereas men are left in the clubs
for
longer.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm against gender quotas. I'm all about the gender quotas.
Do you feel like that's ever happened to you? Like that you've been on a stage where you've suddenly gone, I'm not ready for this?
Oh, yeah, all the time. But that's...
Is that just imposter syndrome though?
Yeah, of course. But you have to challenge yourself all the time. Like if at the moment I'm, you know, my agents are pushing me to book a Vicar Street and I'm worried that I won't be able to sell it. So they're like, you have to take a chance. Whereas I'd much prefer to book a smaller venue, sell it, not have the stress of it. Mm-hmm. Whereas they're like, no, you have to go take yourself to the next level now. So what if you sell 10 tickets? You have to take the chance on it. I would be riddled with imposter syndrome. Who isn't?
Do you look back now on any of your gigs and like...
Just to clarify, I'm all about gender quotas.
Oh, yeah.
It's like all about them. Like, you know, I... think there was especially in comedy areas that were just shut off to women because it was just assumed you weren't up to it, you weren't able for it. And so gender quotas were absolutely necessary to break that barrier and to let women in, whether it be chat shows, panel shows, whatever it was. And then once that happens, then it can be done on merit again. And it's not like those women are going to be put in if they're not good enough. It's that whoever's running that show just doesn't think that any women are good enough.
Needs to have a bigger pool of talent to pick
from. Exactly.
To be able to go, oh yeah, you know what, there are women who talk about that. There are women who are experts in economics as well. There are women who talk about this.
And who, like what they do, what people I think really forget is that as a punter sitting in the audience of a lineup of a festival or whatever, it's so much more interesting to have different perspectives.
Yeah.
Like, why do you want to see the same man get up and tell the same story about his divorce and hating his wife? And like, grand, like one of that, great, that's funny, let's go with that. Then I want someone else, and then I want someone else, and then I want someone else, and then I want someone else.
Yeah. There's a really interesting discussion going on about this right now, and I'll link it in the show notes. But Lionel Shriver wrote a piece for... Oh, I can't remember. It was like something big, the New York Times or something. But she was talking about, because Penguin has said that it's bringing in diversity quotas for its authors in the UK. And by, I think, 2025, it wants its stable of authors to represent the UK better. So to have more Indian authors and to have more Pakistani authors and to have more people of colour. And Lionel Shriver, who is an author, a female author, you know, she wrote We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Yeah.
And she came out and basically said that she thought this was really damaging for creativity. And I'm like, if I paraphrase her, I'll paraphrase her wrong because it was definitely a very detailed and academic piece. But I did think it was very interesting because I would love to hear somebody who is Indian or Pakistani or a person of colour saying they think it's wrong.
Yeah.
It's easy for her to be like, well, I've made it this far and I'm white and I'm now really rich.
Yeah, I know.
And I think this is a bit ridiculous. And yeah. Like, well, what do the people think who haven't been given those chances?
Yeah, I know. And it's a difficult one as well because then there are people who are talented in, say, if it's like say white women or whatever, I don't know, again, like, I don't know enough about writing and publishing and all, but like, I know that the Film Board, I think, are doing something similar, that they want the Irish Film Board, that they want in a couple of years time for it to be 50-50, which
men
means,
and women.
Yeah. And now again, I'm paraphrasing to within an inch of my mind. Someone told me this after we'd had seven wines, but there was something along the lines of that now they're not actually taking male applications at entry level,
which
in
is
a lot
kind of
places
problematic
because they have to get this
The quotas up. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, the thing is riddled with problems, but I think there's always going to be those issues, and then it'll eventually balance itself out. And we're at that really awkward, niggly stage at the moment. Yeah. But something we are doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And I think there's always collateral damage in these things, and you're it's whether you think it's worth kind of, it's worth it for the bigger picture.
Yeah.
You know,
but I mean, you only have to look at, they released the lineup for, I think it was Taste of Cavan or something the other day, and there were these like press photos, and there were five men in them. Do you know what I mean? And you're like, you really couldn't get woman.
I know, but now it's like, who's you doing your PR? Like, it's tone deaf now to not have different people represented and things like that.
But sometimes, like I had a conversation with somebody recently who was doing something like, they were taking photos for their company's website. And I said, you know, make sure, because I've been in there and I knew it was like mostly white men, like a lot of companies are. And I said, make sure you get your one in and make sure you get that Indian guy and that black guy. And they were like, oh God, I wouldn't even thought of that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why the fuck not?
Yeah.
But also, you don't want to misrepresent it and be like, we're really multicultural, when literally you have 100 white men and three other people.
I know. And that's the thing. A lot of it can be aesthetics as well. And you don't know, like, you're kind of, people might feel like they're just getting wheeled out for the photo calls, and then they're thrown into the back of the office again, and you don't see them again for another year, you know?
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I'd say that's happening.
You just
a
sort
lot.
The post back here. Yeah, and then when it comes to like corporate photo time, we'll put a suit on you and take
CEO,
you out the front.
Yeah.
So tell your show, Bite Me.
Mm.
Your show. Let me tell you about your show.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Which I didn't see. Because I was meant to go with my friend. And then what happened? I think I was too depressed. Like, that's not hyperbole. But that was all about your eating disorder.
Yeah.
So obviously you're someone who minds your own experience for your comedy. Do you do that with like, do you take bits of your friends and family and what they say to you and their experiences? And how do you decide what's too much to take or too much to share?
My family tell me. So it's happened twice maybe that, because I'd be kind of like, I'd be pretty, I just kind of talk. And it's happened once or twice where I had like my family ring me and be like, not cool. I don't want to be discussed in this way. I don't want to be discussed in that way. And I had to, at the time, I was like, well, sensitive, who cares? And then I had to accept defeat and be like, yeah, grand, I won't ever talk about them again. And things like, I'm adopted. So I used to talk, not in detail or anything, but talk about my adoption and finding my birth parents. And then my birth mother contacted me and was like, don't talk about me. So like, it happens a lot. I tend to just talk until someone tells me to not talk about them anymore. But I'm more aware of it now.
So you're of the like ask for forgiveness, not permission school of thought.
I was, but now I'd be more wary.
Okay, yeah.
I'm more aware of it now. Plus, I suppose the more work you do. At the time, I just felt like no one's reading this stuff. You forget that people, it's like that mirror. Like I can't, like, that's so stupid. Do you know that kind of way? You forget that people are looking to make stuff out of this stuff.
But
to
you
fill
also, I mean, you also whatever. Forget, I think, that everything that we do now is permanent.
Yeah.
So someone's tweeting a quote from your show, or someone's taking it down, putting it on Facebook, or someone, even if it's not filmed, it's not recorded.
Yeah.
It's and never going away. It's so scary.
That's, context is a big issue as well in the world of comedy. Like stuff that you would say, like if you wrote, like I've been at gigs where if you wrote out that set and put it online, they'd probably never work again.
Yeah,
but in
yeah.
the room and within the vibe of it, and they're yeah. killing. Everyone's hysterical. They're like people stuck to the ceiling laughing so hard. It's just yeah. context has a lot to do with it as well. And those kind of quotes that they pull out, one line here and one line there, they can be very misleading.
Yeah. And I mean, it's all timing as well, because if you think about, say, like the week before the referendum that just was, if you had come out and done a like jokey, you know, the problem with feminists is set, you would have been killed.
Yeah,
like,
of course.
In Dublin, like in a certain area, yeah. because everybody was up to 90. But if you did it the day after, it would have been like, this is gas because yeah. we're all relaxed now.
Yeah, all the tension was released. Yeah. You could say, yeah, completely. And it's funny, like even the second the referendum was over, I remember I tried to do something about abortion in a club. People just weren't interested anymore. It's over. Yeah. It's done.
They just like don't want to talk about it
yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, it's just over. And it wasn't even stuff about repeal. It was just like, I can't remember what the joke was now, but I was like, "All right, we're no one cares about that anymore." Wow, because it was a stage where making an abortion joke in a comedy club, and this was like up before the referendum, yeah. would still suck the air out of the room.
Yeah,
in the UK you could do it, no bother. Here it was still a really
and
of course
was
so
sensitive about it as
yeah,
well. Yeah,
so sensitive about it.
Yeah. So if Bite Me was about your eating disorder, is Wine Tamer about your alcoholism?
No. No, although my mum was asking me that. No, it's not. So I've kind of, the eating disorder thing felt like, it was Una McKevitt, who I work with a lot. She was the one who directed Singlehood. And she's actually my best mate's sister. So we grew up knowing each other, but Una was always the kind of very scary,
older
power lesbian sister who listened to loads of Sinead O'Connor and Hated the Church. And so I was terrified of her. Like, we'd no relationship at all. And then she began to mellow a bit as she got older. And
not like you got mature.
No, she mellowed. Came back to the church. Nobody nothing. She mellowed a bit and I got a bit more mature. And she was in the civil service at the time. And she was dying to get out. Like, that family, they'd be quite creative and they read a lot and stuff. And she was like, I want to write. I want to do something in theatre. And she was like, I'm going to put together this show called Singlehood. She asked me, I was at the Electric Picnic. I had done nothing at this stage. I was just out of treatment. So I was really at a loss. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had left my job. I'd had to because I'd gone mad. So I was kind of swinging in the wind. And she said, do you want to do this? I think she kind of felt that it would be something I'd enjoy doing. I was always a bit of a show pony, not like in an irritating way, just in a normal
way. That's
what you think. Yeah, I know. Yeah. That's why I said that at the end. I was like, oh God, it makes me sound terrible. But I always loved telling stories and all. And so I got involved with that. So that was the first stage stuff I'd done. That was about being single and all that jazz. And then Una suggested, because I'd written all this stuff, I'd written Bite Me. I thought maybe I might try and turn it into a book or something.
Yeah.
I just knew that writing made me happy now and that I didn't have to do my old job anymore. And now kind of the world was my oyster, even though I had no money and I was still quite unwell at the time. But I knew that I had to do a change of career.
Yeah.
And she said, look, why don't we make a show out of Bite Me? So we did that. And yeah, I'm really proud of Bite Me. It was a great little show and we got 2 years out of it, I toured and we went to Edinburgh and there's talk of it going to Soho now. So then you're like, right, do I just have to come up with, do I have to have a mental health issue every time I want to write a show? Like, is that the deal? So Wine Tamer is nothing about anything. As in, like, it's just
a comedy
classic
show.
Stand-up show. Yeah. It's just jokes. I mean, I definitely drink too much. There's no doubt about that.
Well, we're Irish.
Yeah, I know. That's why we kind of get away with it.
Yeah. But you know, whenever you hear Americans, especially young Americans, saying like, oh, I'm actually teetotal because I'm an alcoholic. Mm. And you're like, I bet that fucking, and like, I'm sorry, this is very disrespectful, but I bet that fucking means that you drink 5 beers on a Friday.
Yeah.
And then you wake up with a hangover. Like, that's our 3 days a week.
I know, but they're we're in the wrong.
Oh no, I know. Yeah. When I lived in Italy, I remember when I wasn't like on the nights off that I wasn't working at the bar, I would go and like sometimes they made me pay for my drinks because I was like, I'll go and drink for free. But no, I used to get like 2 free drinks. But after about 3 drinks, they'd be like, "Are you going home now?" I'd be like, "What the fuck are you talking about?
I'm only getting
going." Yeah, it's like 10 o'clock.
I know.
I'm gonna have 6 more, and then I'm gonna go to that club up there. It's so bad.
It's really bad. And like at the moment, I am fascinated with women and how we drink, because there's now more females representing or presenting with alcoholism than males in Ireland, which is the first time in history. And I worry, what is it doing to my insides? Like, there's women with liver failure now, women in their 30s, and it's this wine o'clock. It's yeah. This chic refreshment. Oh, this is like female, and we're just business women having a wine.
It's like t-shirts that say like time for Prosecco.
Yeah.
Prosecco hour. Yeah.
Why not? And actually, we've convinced ourselves that we're like, you know, touching on sommeliers, and actually we're just pissheads. And I do wonder what effect it's having on my body. And I also wonder like, how much of it is habit? Like, what's the difference between being an alcoholic and having alcohol dependency issues? Mm-hmm. If you have to have a drink every day, are you an alcoholic? Or is an alcoholic someone who can never have just one drink? I mean, I know you don't have the answers. These are just questions I ask myself.
Au contraire, Joanne. I do have some.
Do you?
No.
Oh.
Well, I have some opinions. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, go.
I think alcoholism is almost like, say if I said depression, right? That's kind of a spectrum. That includes the person who like is having like serious suicidal thoughts and can't get out of bed. And it includes the person who's getting out of bed and going to work, but then feels like crying every time, you know, every evening when they come home. So the same way alcoholism, I think a lot of people could be alcoholics if they tick several of the following boxes, which are like, you absolutely need to drink every day.
Yeah.
You cannot stop drinking once you start drinking. You drink all day and night and you wake up in the morning and have a whiskey chaser. You know what I mean? So like, I do think there are like, there's a spectrum where there's somebody who cannot function. But then there's like the insidious, the like, I drink a bottle of wine 5 nights a week because I'm really stressed in work.
I know.
And, like, are you an alcoholic? You could probably give it up if you wanted to, but you're also drinking way too much.
Yeah, exactly. That's exact. And that's where I think a lot of women are actually.
Yeah.
Our age women, that's what they're doing. They're kind of sinking. A 2 glasses of wine, 3 glasses of wine, 4 glasses of wine a night, because they're stressed and like they're just they switch off. Like that's what I use wine for. It's to switch off. And in my mind, it's my reward. I'm like, oh, I've had a really busy day now. I've done this and I've written this, and I'll reward myself with wine. And then I get really paranoid, and I'm like, because I had, you know, I was very sick with the eating disorders, and that is an addiction, like, you know, bulimia, anorexia, like it is an addiction, that I worry. I'm like, oh God, like, am I now substituting wine with what was bulimia? I used to smoke a lot. I'm on the vape now. Like, I just feel like I always need to have something to change my state. I'm always trying to like change my state evenings.
I think as well, once you're any kind of addict, whether it's like cigarettes. So like, I used to smoke, although I've started smoking again lately, which is really annoying and stupid.
What?
I know.
And what about the skin? Weights and all?
I know. I'm still lifting-ish. Yeah. But like not 5 times a week, like once or twice a week now.
Yeah. No, I'm so...
I'm taking a slide. It's too hot.
Yeah, it's very hot.
But...
smoking, that's the thing.
Smoking's desperate.
And to be honest, and this is desperate, but the cancer doesn't seem to stop me. But when I think about my face, that stops me because I'm like, it'll ruin my face.
You know what stopped me the first time? So I gave up... I'd quit for like 4 years and just completely cold turkey because I went for fertility testing and I found out that I had a really low egg count.
Mm.
Right? And I've never... particularly wanted kids, or actually up until probably this year I would have said I definitely don't want kids. This year I'm a bit like, oh, maybe they're all right.
Yeah,
that one's cute, you know, that one's a shithead, but that one's all right. But I went for fertility testing, and when they came back and they said, yeah, you've like the eggs of like a 55-year-old woman, right?
No.
I was suddenly like, what? And I suddenly went, here's this thing that I can't control, like my little eggs, and then here's the thing that I can control, smoking. And I was like, why am I doing this when this is going to make this even worse? Like, this is going to kill even more eggs, and I don't have that many to begin with. But what I was going to say is that I think if you're somebody who's been addicted to anything, whether it's like exercise, whether it's, you know, anorexia, bulimia, smoking, drugs, there's always the temptation, or there's always the worry that you're replacing it with something else.
Yeah, exactly.
So like, there's loads of stuff that I just would never do. So like, I have never done drugs. I've never done any kind of pills. I've smoked hash when I was younger because that's what we did when I was younger. Because I'm basically like, I know that I would love it.
Yeah.
And I know that I would wake up the next day and be like, when are we doing that again? Because even when I'm smoking, I wake up in the morning and I'm like, when am I smoking?
God, that's such self-control to know. If I was like, I know I'm going to enjoy that, I'd be like, that's why I'm going to do it.
No, but I think, I mean, because I was listening to another podcast. So I listen to the New York Times, The Daily every day. So they do like news from America. It's the news from America. And today they were talking about the opioid crisis.
Mm.
And they were talking about how people who are prescribed fentanyl patches for pain relief, and they open up the patches and they eat them. And like they were talking about this couple that was opening up the patches and dividing them and eating them between them. And you get this huge, it's basically like taking heroin.
Wow.
And I was literally sitting there going, I'd love to get some fentanyl. Where did I get that? Where could I get that? I'd love to. But I was also going, I feel like if I did any of that, like another friend of mine told me that she went to a party a couple of weeks ago and they took two Valiums and drank a bottle of Prosecco. And she was like, I've never been so happy in my entire life. Right.
And that I think, does sound lovely. I know. Floaty.
But I think as well, because I'm depressed, I'm like, if I did that, I could never go back to my real life.
No.
I would wake up the next day and be like, I'm killing myself because I'm so down now compared to where I was.
Oh, yeah.
So I could never do the fentanyl or any of that now.
No, you really have to watch, because especially, like, to be honest, like, alcohol, like, I know when I've had, like, some heavy drinking sessions, and I take, like, Prozac still from off the back of when I was bulimic, because it stops all your compulsions, and I just never came off it because I just don't want to take the chance.
Yeah.
But like, if I can go, if I can get that really, you know, the fear, but like more than the fear, this insane feeling of, because drink, it basically just sucks all the endorphins out of your body and your brain and all your serotonin, everything's gone. Definitely if you're depressed, you shouldn't drink at all.
Well, I stopped drinking.
Just suck the top of a deodorant can or something.
Ugh. Actually, there's a bathroom in work that always smells like Lynx. Anyway, I didn't drink at all for like.
I love Lynx.
No, I like Lynx, but this smells like teenage boys' bedroom Lynx. It's not like, no.
Is it Lynx Africa?
I don't know what it is.
Is it Lynx Apollo?
I don't know what it is. Okay. It's some kind of Lynx.
Yeah, love it.
Listen, it could be like Old Spice. Who knows? I'm generalizing. Oh, God.
No.
But what was I going to say?
Drinking.
Oh, yeah. I didn't drink for probably about 18 months or 2 years. And lately I've started drinking again, but not like, so I wouldn't say I drink in the way that most are. I'm not like most Irish girls.
Yeah.
But I kind of would have the odd glass of wine. But like that, I'm like, I can't really get drunk.
Yeah.
Because the next 2-3 days are so miserable.
Yeah. It's not worth it.
Like, it is worth it in the moment.
But at least you can connect the two. You can connect the two, though. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I'm very, if you know that marshmallow test, like, I've no sense of delayed.
No. Oh, if you could have one marshmallow now or two marshmallows later.
Yeah, I'd be a big marshmallow now girl. Like, I've no sense of delayed, what is it, delayed gratification. Like, I have to, I'm quite self-indulgent. Like, if I want it now, I'll have it now.
I wonder what I would be. I think, like, years of Weight Watchers would make me go, like, have the one marshmallow because it's half the amount of points.
Yeah.
But then 10 minutes later, I'd be like, fuck it, I should have taken the two marshmallows.
Yeah. Yeah. Rage me yourself.
Yeah, I'd be so annoyed.
They're quite low in points, marshmallows. Because back in the day, because I did Weight Watchers back in the day as well, that they only counted fat in things. They didn't take sugar into consideration.
But they changed it now.
Yeah, of course they have. Yeah.
God, if you could get your hands on some of the old books, you could really have a great time.
I know.
Not counting any sugar, but this is great. Okay. So I was Googling you today, right, because I wanted to see the name of your shows, because I didn't know off by heart.
That's okay.
And I found loads of pictures of you, and you had lovely red hair.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But I also found a picture of you standing beside Blind Boy, and I want some insider gossip. Is he a ride? This is my obsession.
Are you obsessed with Blind Boy?
No, I'm obsessed because somebody told me he was a ride.
He is very good looking, yeah. He is, yeah. He is, yeah.
Okay.
They're both actually very good looking. The other one who...
Boat Club? Everybody forgets. No, he's Blind Boy Boat Club. Yeah, what's the other one?
I can't remember, but they're both
where
actually quite
hot. Where's
the
other one?
I don't know.
He doesn't get his time in the sun.
No.
Blind Boy's really now
taken off.
Blind Boy's really like the Meryl Streep of that Death Becomes Her equation, isn't he?
Okay, Death Becomes Her is one of my favourite films ever.
Have you been watching Love Island?
No.
Oh.
I know, sorry.
Because I think Wes is really the Bruce Willis character in Love Island.
Really?
So Wes in Love Island was with this girl for a couple of weeks. They were getting on really well. He told her he was falling for her.
Oh, I know this story.
Yeah, and then...
Laura. Yeah.
And then Megan comes along and is like, I think I kind of fancy you.
Yeah.
And he immediately is like cartoon, like heart's coming out of his eyes, dumps Laura And I think like Laura is the Meryl Streep character.
Oh, very
going,
good.
Like, oh, hello. And yeah. Bruce Willis going, forget about this one that I love. I yeah. fancy you now.
Well, I was reading an article today. I was saying that women ringing up clinics looking for cosmetic procedures and fillers has gone up 75%.
Well, I thought you were going to say 700. I am not surprised because yeah. I would be pretty. I'm not anti plastics. I'm not anti cosmetic surgery, but I'm anti the culture that makes us all think we want it. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I'm also going, if you want to get it done, like you only get one life and you have to live here, and if it's going to make you happier. And I'm literally now going, you know what could make me happier? I had a dream the other night that I had dermal fillers in my jawline. You can get that done to make your jawline look more defined.
Okay.
And I had this dream and I woke up and I was really sad.
That so you hadn't had it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to go and get the jawline fillers. Mm. And I'm literally now going, maybe I could just get a bit of Botox, just get a bit of lip filler. Like, because Megan is fucking right. She is gorgeous. Now,
20 grand is what she's put into her face. 20 grand.
But listen, I've put 20 grand into my wardrobe and I still have nothing to wear. Yeah, so I'd rather put it in my face.
I'm not against it. Like, I'm not against it. I do think that, what do I think? I think it's weird territory. I think, like you, I hate that suddenly it's porn. I blame porn.
Well, yeah, well,
I blame porn.
But also the pornification of everyday life. So, like, I was reading an interesting article as well about how 5 or 6 years ago, looking like a Kardashian was weird. Do you know what I mean? That, like, they looked like weird robot dolls and everyone was like, they look mad. And, like, look at their mad arses. Whereas now everyone looks like them.
Yeah.
And, like, all of the top beauty and fashion influencers all look like Kardashians now. But they all have the same.
The big lips and all. They look like, I think they look like they've come out of one of those Japanese vending machines that sells the knickers that businessmen smell. Like, there's just something, they're so sexual. And like these huge, big blowjobby lips. I'd love to have lips like that naturally. I would love it so much. I think big lips are so sexy and beautiful. But when you've had them filled, you can always tell. And I think you lose points then. You win points if you get them naturally.
It's not a game.
It is a game.
What I mean is that
if you're admiring someone's appearance.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
If it's a natural thing. Yeah.
But that's what's funny about Megan is that when she first came on Love Island, she actually looks quite natural. So everyone's just like, she is just a beautiful looking girl. Yeah. And then this all came out and you're like, oh my God, she looks so different before. And now it's like, oh, it's all surgery.
Her work, I know it sounds very Hollywood now, but her work is amazing.
Her work is amazing.
It's amazing. Now, bearing in mind, she's also, what age is she, 20 something?
Yeah, 20-something. You know what you reminded me of there with the Japanese vending machines? In this woke feminist group I'm in,
Which I'm now fascinated by.
Yeah, it is really fascinating. There's a lot of talk about money. And there's a lot of talk about how to make money and how to ask for promotions and people saying, you know, I've just found out that I'm getting paid less than my colleagues and blah, 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 and what do I do? And I mean, it's women, so there's a lot of talk about relationships as well and there's a lot of talk about everything. But one woman came on and said, I'm in college, I'm really broke, I'm looking for a quick way to make money. Does anybody know, I think she was saying, does anybody know any of those good survey sites? So do you know 10 years ago you could do surveys online and get a tenner?
Yeah.
And you can't really do that anymore because there's too many people online basically.
Yeah.
And she was like, does anybody know any good survey sites? Like, I have time, but I just need to make a quick buck. And somebody commented and was like, if you're not squeamish about it, you should look into selling your knickers. She was like, there's this site, my friend does it, she makes $250 a week. She's like, you don't put a picture of your face, but she puts up pictures of her body. And she was like, you might get some odd requests. Sometimes they ask for like knickers you've gone to the gym wearing.
Yeah.
Knickers you've like free bled in. So you've worn while you had your period and no tampon or anything. They'll ask for like knickers you've slept in, like wear them for 4 days straight. And she's like, so if you can put up with that, it's great. And once again, I was like, maybe I'll do that.
Does that not go against feminism in some way? Does that not feel anti-feminist? Or is that the empowering part of feminism?
I think the empowering part of feminism is I can make money from the patriarchy. The patriarchy that has kept me down, now I can take advantage of this pornification of the world and go, you know what? I'm going to use this to make fucking money.
Yeah.
Like from a like very extreme feminist point of view, you'd be like, that's really gross and we shouldn't be fueling like men basically dictating what you do and don't do with your knickers and then buying them from you.
Yeah.
My main issue is, right, GDPR, right?
Yeah.
So like, what are you doing with my DNA? How long are you going to keep it?
Yeah.
How do I know you're not sampling that DNA? How do I know you're not putting me into, what's that thing called in America? That database and then I could be found guilty of a crime that I've never done a crime, but like if I did,
yeah,
that this is, or like the Golden State Killer, that you're going to put this into my heritage, you're going to find my relatives and then people are going to know that I'm related to the Golden State Killer.
Or like, Black Mirror, do you know when they cloned
yeah,
I mean that seems like that's literally around the corner. Black Mirror seems almost kind of like it predicts the future now rather than mocks the future.
Well, I think since Donald Trump got elected, we're in Black Mirror now.
We are in Black Mirror now, yeah.
Like, and I was seeing a thing today that when he comes to the UK, they're erecting this giant blimp of him. It's like a baby Donald Trump, right?
Yeah.
But I was like, it's so bizarre that this is happening and he's going to see that. Like, and like, I was almost kind of feeling sorry for him, but I was like, well, how's he going to feel? What's
I know. I did read an interview with him. I heard, sorry, I didn't read an interview with him. I heard a sound clip taken and he was saying, I had to ask, am I really that bad? And like my feeling about Donald Trump, because he was talking about like people hating him.
Yeah.
Is that I think Donald Trump is one man, right? He's a businessman. Yeah. Like, he's a complete narcissist, I'd imagine. I don't know how Melania even deals with it. But I think he
say
is...
Say she doesn't.
No, I think now
say their
she
time
definitely
together is
doesn't.
Minimal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think he is the...
Conclusion?
I think Donald Trump is a consequence of something. I don't think he started anything himself.
Do you think, well, like, we almost wished him into existence by the way, like, the way the world is going made him?
Yeah, I
like,
think...
Like, we facilitated his rise to fame by being obsessed with reality TV, by...
No!
Not us, like, everybody,
I think,
the world.
I think if you don't live in America, it's very hard to understand what's actually going on over there. I think emigration is a huge issue over there, no more than it is here. That like that's why that was why Brexit happened was emigration and
immigration. You mean
immigration?
Or, like people coming in?
People coming in? Sorry, yeah. Immigration.
I was like, I don't think that many Americans leave America.
Sorry, immigration. And I think it's very hard for us sitting over here. It's so easy for us to go that racist bastard, and like that's oversimplifying what's actually going on over there. I think it's a really complicated situation.
Yeah.
I think America's split right down the middle on it. Yeah, so I think kind of, I know that people are directing their anger at him, like just him,
which,
and then calling everyone who voted him in a racist, and that's just not the case.
No.
It's way more complicated than that.
Yeah, and actually, like it almost deflects from the real issues, which are like, why is there such huge
what's
inequality?
Happening?
Like,
why
is there
is
such
he there?
Massive employment in Wisconsin? Why is this happening?
Like, why is there a shift to the right globally?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
why is
yeah.
that happening? What's going on there? And it's the same in the UK. Like,
yeah, I know.
That it's pretty much
but
the exact
here.
Same thing.
Not
we're
here. We're actually remarkably liberal.
But we are we're very liberal and very progressive, yeah.
Yeah,
and
we give ourselves all down.
Oh, yeah, he's made some comment about Trump, did he?
But Trump is kind of right about the media or something.
Yeah, but I'd imagine, I can just imagine you're in that position. Do you remember he got some politician was given out to him because he had an expensive jacket?
Yeah. And well, that was bullshit.
His
jacket costs 4 weeks of the dole, and you're like, what do you want him to be going around in rags?
Yeah,
like he
I
can
know.
Do what he wants with his wage. Like that's
yeah,
just
it's
stupid.
His wage.
Like,
exactly. But you imagine just being like at that all the time.
Yeah.
My favorite quote was Donald Trump when he met the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong, whose name I always get wrong.
Kim Jong Il. Yeah.
And Donald Trump said, "I like Kim Jong Il. His people respect him." Yeah.
Did he actually say that?
He goes, I have a lot of admiration for him because his people respect him. They show him respect. I.e., you don't show me respect. He's a dictator. His people are terrified of him. I went to the most interesting talk on North Korea. I go to the Dorky Book Fest most years. It's only on 3 years, I think. And it's so good. It sounds boring. It's not at all. And I went to this amazing chat this year on North Korea. The woman's name was Soo Kim. I've probably got that wrong. I'm really bad at names. But she kind of infiltrated North Korea for like 10 years in various guises. And it's about that and like kind of being on the inside and everyone's lying in North Korea. So she went in as a Christian, lying because she's not a Christian, to get in with the Christian group who were also lying about being Christians. It's just madness. But she was saying this, he's called the great leader, and everything in North Korea is about the great leader. You can't play music unless it's singing for the great leader. They have a newspaper that comes out, every story in it is about the great leader. She was like, it's so wild.
It's nuts, isn't it?
So wild. Yeah, so wild. And it's fascinating to listen to her talk.
But it must be so stressful as well if you're Like, have you seen The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah.
So you know the way in The Handmaid's Tale, none of them know who's... So you know when, like, Offred meets of the other one, I can't remember her name, but when she meets her shopping partner and she doesn't realise that she's kind of in the resistance too and that the two of them are fucking fucked off with this life. And, like, they haven't said anything because they're both pretending to be perfect, to be really nice. Yeah. She's like, I thought you were really pious. And she's like, well, I thought you were... It must be so stressful to be in North Korea and be like, I really want to chat to someone about how nuts this is.
But you can't. They all spy. It's like the Stasi. Yeah. They're all obligated to report on each other.
It's like your baby brother.
Yeah.
Your big brother.
Yeah.
Baby brother.
As in, what you mean?
With his SS outfit.
Oh, my big brother. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Reporting on me to my parents and all. He used to do that. He used to, in the morning, he'd give me Alpen with... milk, and he'd give me ice cream after dinner, and then I'd eat it, and then he'd take a picture of me while I was eating it, and then go up and tell my parents I ate it, even though he'd given it to me. So when we got our photos, you know, back in the day when and you get your photos developed, and there was just constantly pictures of me in the fridge or eating sandwiches I wasn't allowed to eat, or eating ice cream I wasn't allowed to eat.
Do you think this had anything to do with your eating disorder?
No, but do you know what it was for him? Because he's 5 years older than me, and for those 5 years before I arrived on the scene.
Oh, he was having a great time.
He was the Fabergé egg of the family. Everyone was obsessed with him. Beautiful looking little boy. And then I arrived on the scene. Boom. It was all over for him. It was
and all
about
me. All of a
sudden
he was in the SS costume and you were the princess.
Suddenly, basically, yeah.
Well, Joanne.
Well, Rosemary.
We've reached the end of
our
time
together. Thanks for coming
on my podcast. Oh my God.
It's been so nice to have you.
You should do a podcast.
I'd love to do a podcast. I'd love to.
You've got a very annoying voice.
I know.
No, you don't.
Do you think we have the same accent though?
I'm from Kildare. Yeah, pretty much. I don't have a Kildare accent at all.
No, but you would have
a SoCo Do accent as well. Yeah. I think we have a pretty similar.
I'd love to do a podcast, and I was going to do one, but I didn't want to do one on my own. And then
it's hard.
Yeah, and I have more crack with other people.
Yeah.
And then I was going to do one on interview. The person I was doing it with, the network, were like, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to do something like this. And they said a very good point, which I'm sure you've taken into consideration. They said, if you make your podcast about your guests, like the listener will only listen if they are interested in that guest.
Yeah.
So you have massive drop off with certain people, which you'll probably have with me, and then massive gains with other people. And so they were like, if your podcast is themed...
Yeah.
Generally,
and people are interested in the theme.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of why I talk so much on my podcast, because I want my podcast to be kind of about me as well.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So that when people listen in, they're like, oh, I like Rosemary McCabe's podcast. I wonder who she has on this week.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But no, like it is definitely, because I've like the odd week where you're like, oh, you don't have a guest. Could I just talk myself? I don't know if I would.
I know. It's hard.
I love talking.
Like, you have
hard.
To write. Like,
you have to write it all out. Yeah.
You'd have to write it out, what you're going to talk about and stuff. Like, it's intense. You know what I mean? It's a lot of work. Like, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. No, it is a lot of work. Where can people find you if they want to follow you, buy tickets to your gigs, buy your t-shirt?
So I'm on Twitter at Joe McNally, and I'm on Instagram, Joanne McNally Comedy. And I'm kind of on Facebook, but I think Facebook's dead now. Isn't it? It's kind of just for my mom.
I was about to say, my mom's getting into it now, which is the death
sign.
Knell, isn't
it?
It's
a sign,
yeah. And she talks about her friends. She goes, my friend saw this on Facebook. And you're like, it's over now.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. But thank you so much for joining me. And maybe I'll see you on a podcast someday soon.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening to How to Be Sound, for leaving reviews. I truly believe that for every review you leave on iTunes, you get one step closer to heaven. And for supporting me through Patreon, for telling your friends, for tweeting me, Instagramming me, commenting on Facebook, and as one lovely woman did last week, for coming up to me on the street and screaming, Rosemary McCabe, in my face. You know who you are. How to Be Sound is produced by the inimitable Liam Geraghty, whose own podcast, Meet Your Maker, you can find at meetyourmaker.ie. And finally, a big thanks goes to all of my patrons who are at the $3.33 level and above. And they are Paul Jeremiah Hayes, Dina Walker, Karen Cregan, Beatrice McCabe, Siobhan O'Rourke, Stephen Harding, Kira Norton, Marita Leonard, Sharon, Katrina Kennelly, Sean O'Hara, Trisha Sullivan, Emma Dowler, Claire Hegarty, Sharon Lennon, Katie Joy, Aoife Bradley, Niamh Ní Gabhán, Evan McBride, Anya Kelly, Sarah McCann, Michelle Barrett, Sonia Mary, Breed Gallagher, Sinead Fegan, Aisling Dollard, Marina Hogan, Sarah Hanrahan, Heidi Gardner, Eleanor Farrell, Kira McGuinness, Sarah Conroy, Timmy Hennessy, Avril Flynn, Owen D, and Roisin Blade. Thanks.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.